The following AA talk was recorded at the weekly Never Had a Legal Drink group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The opinions of the speaker do not necessarily represent those of the group or AA as a whole. Rather, this story represents one person's experience. If you have a desire to stop drinking and would like help, contact Alcoholics Anonymous at www.aa.org, or you can find AA listed in your local telephone book. AA's Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Yisrael. Hi, everybody. I want to thank Jen for asking me to be here. It is a honor and a privilege to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, I say that because it's an honor because Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. More than saving my life, it gave me the life that I have today. Not everything in my life is directly, it springs forth from my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. From my sobriety springs forth all that is my life. Much of my life has nothing to actually do with Alcoholics Anonymous. But I have to remember where it comes from. And it's a privilege. I mean, I call it a privilege because Dr. Silkworth uses that word when he, in the doctor's opinion, when he says that Bill Wilson came to him and asked him for the privilege of sharing his story with the other patients at the hospital. And Dr. Silkworth says that he begrudgingly consented. In other words, he didn't think it was a good idea, but he figured how much damage can they do to each other, really? You know what I mean? Like, so what? I can't figure out what to do with these guys. Maybe Bill can. Turns out, Bill could. Turns out, we happen to live in a tiny little window of world history that recovery from alcoholism is possible. Now, most people, most alcoholics don't take the solution, don't hear about the solution. Many that hear about the solution don't utilize the solution, but we, those of us that are here tonight, those of us that are, I had this revelation the other night about this idea of day count. Joe, hi, wow. Joe and I knew each other in Los Angeles many years ago. She looks exactly the same and I don't in many, many ways. And we'll get into that in a little bit of time. But there's this, you know, here we are with this potential recovery, and I invite us all to utilize it. I'm particularly honored to speak at a young people's meeting. I got sober in a young people's meeting. I got sober in the Paoli Young People's Group, which met in Paoli, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia. I came to the Paoli Young People's Group on February 6th, 1980. I've been sober since the 14th of February, 1980. I marked my sobriety from that day. That was the day after a guy that I used to buy pills from in school would come to me every day when I got sober and say, "Well, do you want some of these?" No. So the next day, "Do you want some of these?" No. And one day he got to cocaine, and cocaine wasn't really my problem. I couldn't afford it. I was a 16-year-old junior in high school, you know, whatever. So I snorted a couple lines and I went to the AA clubhouse that afternoon, and as the chemical residue was running down the back of my throat and I was a little jumpy, found out that chemicals and the 12 steps don't really mix, even just in casual contact. But I didn't change my date right away, but a few months later I changed it, and it's the 14th of February. And there's so little time and there's so much to say. And that was 31 plus years ago. I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous since then. I'm a I sit before you, an Orthodox Jew who lives in Jerusalem. We're here for the summer. We're visiting. My wife is teaching here in a little yeshiva up on the west side, and we're here for the summer. And I went to that meeting as an Irish Italian Catholic. So I'm not saying that if you work the steps, you'll end up an Orthodox Jew living in Jerusalem. But it could happen. It has happened. Most of the things we worry about becoming if we turn our will and life over to the care of God have never happened. This has happened. So it very easily could happen again. Again, I'm not saying it will happen, but it could happen. Because it has happened. That's all I'm saying. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 16 years old. I'd been drinking for 7 years. I picked up my first drink when I was 9 years old. I had a remarkable evening. I was staying with my cousin in New Jersey's house, and he was 14, 15 years old, and he and his friends robbed houses. Well, they didn't rob houses. They robbed people that robbed houses. They were actually helping because they stole the stolen stuff, and the thieves didn't benefit from their crimes. And one night they stole a case of whiskey and a couple cases of Carling Black Label beer, and they told me I could be the bartender. I could open up everybody's beer and take the first sip. I realized if you're only allowed one sip, take a big sip. It was the last time I ever drank without knowing why I was drinking, because this is the new age, because we're in New York City, because we're in Chelsea. I can explain to you exactly what alcohol did for me. It was like that guided meditation where that voice says, breathe in the golden light. Letting it fill you from the tips of your fingers to the top of your head to the tips of your toes. Let it push out fear and anxiety, filling you with golden light. That's what Carling Black Label did for me. I was 9 years old. I was filled with fear. I was filled with anxiety. I was terrified of everything. And alcohol let me relax. I walked up to a grown man who was walking his dog. I put my arm around his shoulder. I looked him in the eye and I said, get bent. I don't know what that means tonight. But it was the ability. Alcohol gave me the ability. And that's, alcohol was powerful enough for me that we could go to West Philadelphia, which was the equivalent of Lebanon, and buy a case of beer. Three 14, 15-year-old white kids driving in a Pinto or a Bobcat. No one licensed. Buy a case of beer, Colt 45, three guys on a case, 8 beers each. Put it in the woods under a bag of ice and go home, and I felt better. Alcohol was so powerful that I didn't even have to drink it. I simply had to possess it. If I knew that I had beers waiting for me in the woods, I behaved better. I was more patient, loving, and tolerant towards my friends and family and the world in general. That's how powerful alcohol was for me. And I stopped drinking in early February at 16 years old, and I had no idea what was going to happen with my life. And we don't have, you know what I mean? We don't have time. You got to watch out for the speakers that talk about not having time, because they think they have time to talk. You know, the guy that says, oh, I'd never have enough time to tell this story in 30 minutes. See, I've added 5 minutes already. And then they go, in 1947, September 12th, I picked up a drink. September 13th, I picked up another drink. And they just take you day by day through 75 years. Never looking at their watch. Never looking to the flailing arms of the secretary. The distracted looks of the people leaving. Finally opening the pamphlets, thinking it can't be worse than this. So who knows how long I'll talk tonight, but we have to be out by 9 or 10. Shabbos starts at 7:55 tomorrow evening, so I have to be gone by tomorrow night. So I you know, what can I say? I haven't had a drink in 31 years. I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not always the most active sober member. I can explain to you, I've worked the steps several times. I've had sponsors. I've not had sponsors. I've had loving sponsors. I've had poke-you-in-the-chest sponsors. Sometimes the poke-you-in-the-chest sponsors were really good. Sometimes the guys that just called to tell me they love me. You know, I had one sponsor. If he called, it was not to tell me he loved me. It was to ask why I hadn't called him. But not that nicely. You know what I mean? So, I've never not been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't always actively worked the steps in my life, but I haven't not been a member. And I've paid the price for that. For not, because it's not about, like, you know, I have a friend in San Francisco that says that she thought it was get sober and win prizes. That's not the goal. The goal is to have had a spiritual experience. And the goal of that, I mean, it says at the end of, let me see if I can find it quickly. The end of the second chapter, there is a solution, right? Each individual in their personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership, a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only fully by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. But that's what this is. This is the back of the book. Right? In 1940, there was no AA meetings or very few. And so if you lived in Iowa or California or anywhere but Akron or New York and you contacted AA, they sent you the book. And they pretty much said, good luck. And you worked the steps and you read. And how did you figure out if you were an alcoholic? You read the stories and you said, yes, I am. You were persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And this thing is the first 164 pages. This thing is this process of recovery. This thing is somehow breaking the cycle of self that has consumed us. This thing is how do I get from, you know, it talks in the inventory process of fear. It says, you know, fear is this thing in our lives, right? Our lives are, the fabric of our lives are shot through with it. I used to have the book memorized, and then I realized it's all written down, so I don't need to memorize it. But it's, you know, it says that this idea that fear is a volitional act. Let me back up. It says that fear maybe ought to be classified like stealing. So my sponsor said, what does that mean? Stealing is a volitional act. You decide to steal something. You say, she's got a purse and I don't, so I'm going to steal her purse. And you steal her purse, right? But fear, is that really what we do with fear? I mean, my life had been consumed with fear. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of people and situations and places and, you know, everything was just fear-provoking. But I never said to myself, well, you know, I got nothing to do this morning. Maybe I'll just spend the day being afraid. It's a nice enough day, and I've got coffee and a notebook. Maybe I'll just sit here and be terrified. I never did that, not once, but so many days I ended up sitting there terrified. So many moments. I'd say, hello, my name is Yisrael, and then I'd be like sweating. Because they didn't say hello, they did say hello, they were a little too attentive, they were not attentive enough, they were better looking, they were ugly, they were fat, they were thin. Oh my God, what am I going to do? Right? But is it volitional? Yes. How is it volitional? Because I decide to work from self. I don't wake up and say I'm going to be afraid. I wake up and say, you know what, I got a plan for the day. I've got a plan for the week. I've actually got a plan for my entire life. But I'm going to start with today. If this guy does that, and that guy does this, and she does this, and we do that, and then everything will be perfect. And then I got to orchestrate all that. And then I'm just consumed because so when I break that cycle and I find out that I have a power greater than myself in my life, and when I got to AA, that power was me and any one of you. That was where it began. It began with me and my sponsor, but I realized it transferred to me and any one of you. And so when I'm consumed with myself and I'm about to make a really bad decision, if I make a call and I say, "Hi, how does this sound to you?" And then I say it, and already I know it doesn't sound good. I don't really need the other person then at that point because I've already just said it out loud. And it's never a good plan. Certainly not for like many decades into sobriety. But that's my plan, and now I've shared it, and now they can say, "Well, you know, interestingly enough, maybe this might work better. Maybe don't bring the gun." Okay. Or you know what? Bring the gun, but don't bring the bullets. Let's start there. You know what I mean? Like, and then it's out, and then we can talk about it, and then we can move on, and then it's not about me anymore. You know, the book says like something to the effect of 100 forms of self-obsession. You know, and I got sober and I got working on myself and then it was about self-love and self-caring and self, but it's all self. The book tells me clearly, like, you know how many years I spent in AA going, "What is God's will for me?" You know, I had a sponsor, he went to his sponsor when he was new and he said, "I'm afraid that God's will for me is to be a missionary in China." And his sponsor said, "Do you speak Chinese?" And he said, "No." "Do you believe in God?" "No." "Well, why would you make a good missionary in China?" "Probably not what God wants to do with you." "But God, I want to know what God's will. I mean, I'm sincere here. I want to know what's God's will for me. I want to do God's will. I almost destroyed my life. I almost destroyed everyone in my life. I almost blew the whole thing up. And now I don't. I don't drink ever, not never. I don't use any other chemicals that affect me from the neck up with the exception of caffeine, nicotine, and sugar. Don't know why they were exempted. But they were. And we're not discussing it now." Right? I'm sincere. I want to do God's will. I don't always scream it like I am right now. But it's a quiet thought and it's directing my day. And the book says clearly that God's will for me is to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. Well, that's not very exciting, is it? I mean, really? Be of maximum service to God and my fellows. Do you notice who's not mentioned there? Me. Don't you think I would know best what's good for me? And I should be part of the solution for me? No. I'm supposed to take care of you. You're supposed to take care of me. That's this idea again, that me and you together are bigger than me. That's the beginning. I had to grow a God bigger than that for me. I had to convert to another religion and go live in another country because I'm alcoholic. And living in America was just too easy. No, but I mean, I went on a search and I didn't know where I was going to end up, and I didn't think I was going to end up where I am, but I'm here. And it's been an exciting and a beautiful journey. I have a beautiful wife. I have 4 beautiful children. I live in a country where I don't speak the language. It's great. I mean, I speak a little. I speak more Hebrew than you do. But I don't, like, my dry cleaning lady laughs at me. I don't believe in a social hierarchy. But if I did, I would be higher than my dry cleaning lady. And she just has so much fun every time I come in and describe what I want to happen. I mean, in Hebrew, everything is gendered. Everything. Chairs, tables. Why does a chair need to be feminine or masculine? A chair is a chair. Why does a big, tall guy got to be masculine? Doesn't he know when I say, "How are you," in the feminine, that I don't really mean what I'm saying? But that's what I get. That's my life. That's the gift I've been given. You know, I've lived in Los Angeles, I've lived in New York, I've lived in Florida, Southern, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Philadelphia, and Jerusalem. And we have six meetings a week. We have six groups now. We have about 10 meetings a week. Forever, there was one group. One group had a meeting a day. It was only the only group in town. It took a long time to break that cycle. We finally have, and we're starting to grow a little bit. But we're a city the size of San Francisco. I don't know. It's, you know, again, English is the second language there, so it's maybe we shouldn't have as many meetings as San Francisco does. But we should have more than 10. You know, so from an AA standpoint, it wasn't the greatest decision to move there. But life, at some point in my life, and it was early on for me, I was a couple years sober. I was living in Florida. I moved to Florida after I graduated from high school. I should have known then I was going to be a Jew, right? Because I figured I'd take my retirement first. But I got active down there, and I got a sponsor, and he's a tough guy, and we had a big book workshop, and I was a member of the Fort Lauderdale Young People's Group, and I was the chairman of a bid committee, and we tried to get the conference to come to Miami, and we didn't get it. And at that point, I decided I was either going to become like really just turn my life over to Young People's and Alcoholics Anonymous, or I was going to pursue this dream that I had for my own life and let that go. And I let that go, and I don't know if it was the right decision. It was the decision I made, and I went on a journey, and you know, and I started to pursue this dream, you know, it never really, you know, I went to drama school 25 years ago. I wanted to be an actor. I didn't want to be an actor. I wanted to be a movie star. I mean, I wouldn't mind becoming an actor, but I wanted to be a movie star. You know, I wanted prizes. I wanted recognition. I wanted fame. When that New York Times hit that table in the Himalayas, and the Sherpas were getting ready to go to the top, I wanted them to go, "Hun chang ching chong, Yisrael." Do you know what I mean? They didn't have to know everything about New York, but they had to know my face. That's what I wanted. And guess what? I didn't get it. But I got other stuff. You know what I mean? Like, and for good and for bad. You know, I have to tell you, because I always fear those, you know, I always hear those talks sometimes in AA, and it's like, you know, came to AA and I couldn't read. And now I've developed my own language. Do you know what I mean? It's like, really? You couldn't read a page of the big book and now you have your own language? How did you do that? So, like, I have a wife and I have four kids, and you might be thinking, you know, that's not what I want. Do you know? But I mean, I got these little faces, right? Amazing. I'm capable of destroying that too. I'm capable, stone cold sober, 3 decades sober, sober most longer, right, than many of you have been alive, right? If you were born before February 14, 1980, you know what I mean? You can't buy cigarettes here. But you know what I mean? Like, I can blow it up stone cold sober if I decide to move from self. And so I've had to... I almost saved my first marriage. I know how to get married in sobriety. I know how to get divorced. You know, I almost saved my first marriage from self, but I didn't. And then once the marriage was gone, I thought I can act from self again. And to be specific without being overly specific, I had to come to terms in the last six months with a sex addiction, with acting out sexually in a way that was going to destroy my marriage. And I had to stop doing that, and I once more had to return to surrendering to God. And not doing it quietly in the secrecy of my own room, but doing it out loud in public, not, you know, in meetings with people. So that's how I pray. I pray every day. I pray in, you know, several different languages, but the way I pray is I say, My name is Yisrael, and I'm an alcoholic. My name is Yisrael, and I'm a sex addict. My name is Yisrael, and I have to, because I have to do it out loud. My surrender has to be out loud, and it has to be with other people. And I can start to rebuild my life. And I can one more time say, you know what? I want more than this. I don't want to live a diminished life anymore. That's what I did when I got to AA. I said, you know what? I don't want to sleep in the car anymore. I don't have to sleep in the car. I have a house. I mean, I don't have a house, but my parents have a house. I had a perfectly good bed to go to when I slept in the car because that was the best that I could do. And so I decided I'm not going to sleep in the car anymore. I'm going to sleep in the house. I'm going to sleep in the bed. I'm not going to sleep on the couch. Not because I have to sleep on the couch, but because that's where the energy finally ran out. And I can do that today. I did that last night. But I don't have to. And I want to raise the level. I want to live because you know what? That's what we do here. That's what we do here. We say to each other, you know what? We can do better than this. We are doing better than this. We're not drinking today, and we're building a life. And we add in more and more things. Don't drink and go to meeting. It's just the beginning. Just the beginning. And we support each other, and we carry each other, and we bring each other along. You know? And I would have, like...
We got like 30 seconds.
Okay. You think I could tell a 7-minute story in 30 seconds? I'll tell it as fast as I possibly can, okay? And then we'll deal with our resentments later. And I'll be in Jerusalem 7 hours ahead. You can call me anytime you want. 646-546-5405 plus 7 hours. You're welcome to call whenever you want. There was this little chassid, this little guy dressed like me, working in the Diamond District, but in Poland, when the guy that founded Hasidic Judaism was dying. And he died, and he gave each of the little chassidim a job. And this guy's job sucked, like coffee, like ashtrays, like sweeping. Suck job. Not secretary, not speaker, suck job. And so for years, he went around Europe, and he told the stories of the Baal Shem Tov and all the little chassidim. And he didn't know when he was going to stop, and the Baal Shem Tov told him, when he died, you'll know when to stop. And one day he said, you know, I think I'm done. And then he heard that there was a guy paying gold to hear new stories about the Baal Shem Tov. So he said, maybe I'm not done. And he made his way to the guy's house, and the guy welcomed him. He was a nobleman. He had a lot of stuff, and he couldn't think of a single story, not one. And he thought, this is all I do. This is my job. This is my entire purpose is to tell these stories, and I can't think of a single story. For 3 days, he sat there, and he couldn't think of a single story. And then finally, he said, I got to go. This is disgusting. It's disgraceful. I can't believe I'm here. And he left. And the guy didn't want him to leave. And then he thought of one story, seemingly inconsequential, seemingly significant. He went back. He said, I'm not going to take your gold. I just want to tell you the story. And he said, told him the following story. One spring, the Baal Shem Tov said, get the horses ready, we're going to Turkey. Turkey wasn't a good place for Jews in the spring. Christians were Easter, that whole killing the Jews, God, you know, not good. But they went. And they saw the Christian bishop about to have a mass in the town center, and all the Jews were cowering in their homes. And he said, go get the bishop. And he brought the bishop in, the Baal Shem Tov, and the bishop spoke for 3 hours. Finally, they left, and they went home, and everything was, they made it. No one killed them, and they were cool. And he said, I don't know why I'm telling you a story. It's insignificant. It's inconsequential. It makes no sense for me to tell you the story. But when he looked up to apologize for telling the story, the bishop had completely changed. He was crying, and his face had completely changed, and his whole attitude and outlook on life had changed. And he stopped the little chassid, and he said, I was that bishop. I was a big rabbi, and I converted to Christianity, and the Christians so loved that they made me their bishop. And after I went along with the persecution of my own people for all those years, and finally when the Baal Shem Tov came and said, I said to him, is there any way I can be saved, and is there any way I can be forgiven? He said, go and live a quiet life of good deeds, and if ever anyone comes and tells your story, you will know you've been forgiven, you will know you've been healed. And you came to me 3 days ago, and you couldn't tell my story, but I knew you immediately. But you didn't know me, and finally today you told my story, and I know I've been forgiven, and I've been healed. And I'll say this to you, that it's here in Alcoholics Anonymous more than any other place in the world where I hear my story told. And you are the people that tell it. And when I hear my story told here, I know that I've been forgiven and I've been healed. So I beg you to stay. I beg you to take part. I beg you to tell your story so that I can hear my story. Thank you.
The
The preceding AA talk was recorded at the weekly Never Had a Legal Drink group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The opinions of the speaker do not necessarily represent those of the group or AA as a whole. Rather, this story represents one person's experience. If you have desire to stop drinking and would like help, contact Alcoholics Anonymous at www.aa.org, or you can find AA listed in your local telephone book.